So today my goal was to get to Weinberg's theorem. Which is a theorem about the existence of solutions to linear perturbation theory around FRW in the regime where the horizon is much smaller than the wavelength of interest. So let me remind you that if I am interested in a if I'm studying the evolution of a mode with some wave number k, then during inflation, the co-moving horizon ah is a rapidly decreasing function of time, an exponentially decreasing function of time. And then, so we enter this regime where the wavelength of the mode is much larger than the causal horizon. And the mode is basically frozen by causality, a little observer that lives in the inflationary spacetime that just sees a causal patch can't tell that the mode is a fluctuation and not part of the background. And then the situation persists for a while until the inflaton decays to standard model particles. The universe becomes radiation dominated or matter dominated. Same thing would happen either way. AH increases, though the causal horizon becomes larger than the wavelength of the mode, and the mode starts to evolve. So Weinberg's theorem is an interesting statement about what happens in here. I'll state the theorem in a bit, but first, I'm going to have to. So since this is a theorem about the solutions of the equations of motion for various perturbations, I have to tell you what those equations of motion are, and it's going to take a little while since I haven't developed any of the theory of perturbations around an FRW background. It's going to take a little while just to write down the equations. So the first thing I need to tell you about is something called the SVT decomposition. So this stands for scalar vector tensor. So if you consider a system of linear differential equations, with rotation plus translational symmetry, so the fields in my equations could be scalars, vectors, by which I mean three vectors, or let's say symmetric three tensors, and so on. For example, I'm just making up some equations here. So one obvious thing that one can do with this system of equations that you're all used to is Fourier transform. So the reason the Fourier transform is so powerful is because in translation invariance means that k modes, modes of different Fourier wave number evolve independently. K mode evolves independently. And it's actually a consequence that the Fourier transform is going to convert derivatives to algebraic operators because each k-mode evolves without knowing what the other k-modes are doing. So the only things that can appear in the equations are algebraic objects that act on one k-mode at a time. So if I Fourier transform, then that diagonalizes the equations. At a given wave number k, I can write down algebraic equations instead of differential equations. So in this case, for each k, I have like a little set of, I guess this would be 10 equations since I have 1 plus 3 plus 6 components. I'll write this down for reference in a sec. The last two equations, I suppress the k argument. Okay. Now there's another, so far we haven't really used the rotation symmetry, but there's another level of diagonalization one can do that uses that symmetry to help decouple things. So the idea is that around a given, once we take the Fourier transform, we can pretend that whole universe is just a fluctuation at one wave number k and forget about what the other k modes are doing. In that universe, there's a rotational symmetry around the direction of the vector k. And so what you can do is take this system of 10, this set of differential equations in 10 variables, and figure out which variables transform with spins, say, 0, plus 1, plus 2, and so on, around this, with respect to rotations around this axis. So a better name for the SVT decomposition would be the helicity decomposition. Terms scalar, vector, tensor here actually mean helicity 0 plus or minus 1 or plus or minus 2. This terminology, I don't really like this terminology, but it's standard, unfortunately. Okay, so the way this works in detail is that just as with the Fourier transform, you represent a function of x as a sum of plane waves. In this SVT decomposition, I work one Fourier mode at a time, and I take each object with indices and express it as a sum of objects with definite helicity. So if, for example, I have just one Fourier wave number at a time, if I have an object vik with a vector index, then I would write that as, let me write that as the sum from s equals minus 1 to 1. So I'm going to trade this index I for an index s times epsilon I. Okay. Where this guy is a basis vector of helicity s. So to construct that explicitly, my conventions are going to be that epsilon 0, the vector that transforms with velocity 0, i.e. is constant under this rotation, is just the vector pointing in the direction k. And my convention is going to be to put a minus I in front. K hat means the unit vector. The guys with helicity plus or minus 1 are constructed by, if I complete k hat to a orthonormal basis, E1 and E2, then these guys are just E1 plus or minus I, E2. And my normalization is going to be to stick minus I over root 2 in front. Okay, so I would do that with VI or any other vectors that appear here. For the tensor, I want to take the 6 degrees of freedom in the tensor and write them as sums over objects with definite helicity. For the tensor, there's a little bit of a subtlety because the tensor isn't, it has a trace part that comes out separately. The technical term is that this is, if I'd started with a symmetric traceless tensor, this term wouldn't be here, but the tensor without the traceless condition is not an irreducible rotation of SO3, so this term comes out. So there's this trace term. Plus some guys, this is every Fourier mode at a time, so this should have a k, this should have a k. Times some basis tensors with helicity s. Where these guys are, my normalization here is that epsilon 0 is minus k I kj. It's 1/3 delta ij. J1 is going to be 1j. I can build the helicity plus or minus one guy out of my helicity plus or minus one vectors. And then epsilon two there's nothing magic about these weights. You can choose whatever weights you like as long as you use them consistently. What I've done here is traded, say, the 6 degrees of freedom in this equation for 2 degrees of freedom with helicity 0, 2 degrees of freedom with helicity plus or minus 1, respectively, and 2 degrees of freedom with helicity plus or minus 2. If I were just to plug in this form for VI and this form for SIJ, then what I would find is that the different helicities decouple from each other. There's like a diagonalness in the equations. So there's nothing magic about that. You just brute force plug in these representations and see what comes out of the equations. So to do this, for example, for the first equation, just to show how it works, so I have A dot on the left-hand side. On the left-hand side, if I plug in, so the first term stays the same. The second term, if I just take VIK and just mechanically substitute this, what happens when I dot with KI? Well, the plus or minus one terms in the sum give zero in dotted with KI. And the helicity zero term gives, so if I dot with KI, I get minus I times the absolute value of K. And since there's an I here in the equation, that turns out to give plus k times v0. So dotting with ki, I just picked out the helicity 0 term in the sum. And so on. The point is that you're only going to get helicity 0, all the helicity plus or minus 1 or plus or minus 2 terms go away. If I dot ki, kj with s, here I get 1, the helicity 0 term in the sum, I'm going to get minus 2/3. And then these other guys give 0. So putting those terms in with the minus sign, here's what you get. Squared. So the tensor is funny because there's two helicity 0 terms. There's a piece that I'm denoting with t for trace and a piece that I'm denoting with a 0. And likewise, I leave it to you to show that if I just take this right-hand side and plug in and work out the dot products with the k's, then I'll get a right-hand side which is explicitly written out in as a sum over these basis vectors epsilon I. And then if I just match up term by term with the derivative of vi expressed in this form with as a sum over objects with definite helicity, then I get these. I get these equations. And the point is that this is diagonalized in helicity, so it's a little simpler. In this side, I have one equation with only scalars appearing, one equation with only plus or minus one helicities appearing, and so on. You could do the same thing, just to write it down for the tensor. I'll probably give a little homework problem doing this. If you do a lot of these calculations, you can start reading off the decomposition. But if you're in doubt, it's just basically a mechanical process where you substitute in equations like this on both sides of the differential equations and then match up the coefficients of the various basis tensors. We've actually already used this SVT decomposition in special cases without calling it that. When we were going through the constraint solving part of the Maldacena paper. If you think back on that, you'll remember that we had a situation where we were solving for these constraint fields n and ni as some linear function. The linearness is important if the symmetry argument depends on being able to work 1k mode at a time and would break down if I had a nonlinear set of differential equations where 2k modes coupled to source a third k mode. So we were trying to arrive at some expressions for n and ni in terms of these basis fields zeta and gamma ij. Gamma ij here was a traceless symmetric tensor that had been gauge fixed so that it only had the plus or minus 2 helicities. So we had helicity 0 here. N is helicity 0. And ni has helicities, generally speaking, for a vector, if there's no gauge fixing or anything going on, has helicities 0 and plus or minus 1. When this came up, we were able to simplify by noticing that gamma could not source n or ni at linear order and be in a way that was consistent with symmetry. That's just a special case of this SVT decomposition. The helicity 0 and plus or minus 1 parts over here can only be functions of 0, of guys of the same helicity over here. And there's no helicity plus or minus 2 on the left-hand side. So we were able to set this to 0 at the beginning of the calculation. The next simplification we could make is noticing that because there are no helicity plus or minus 1 fields on the right-hand side, there's no way that the helicity plus or minus 1 pieces of ni can get sourced, which is the same thing as saying that ni is a pure gradient. Like, we were able to sort of simplify the calculation from the outset by noticing that ni has to end up being the gradient of something and solve for psi instead. Saying that for a vector field you only get helicity 0 on the right-hand side, a helicity 0 component, is the same thing as saying it's a pure gradient. It says that for each Fourier mode k, the vector points in the direction of k. Okay, so just to do just to play this counting game, if I have a scalar field appearing in a set of differential equations, and then I SVT transform the equations, then I'll have one scalar degree of freedom, no plus or minus 1 or plus or minus 2 components. A 3 vector like this, a symmetric 3 tensor like this. If I had put traceless symmetric tensor, there would only be one here. So there's nothing about the SVT decomposition that requires the 3 vectors involved to be part of a larger 4 vector. But of course, when we apply this to FRW perturbation theory, that'll always be true. For a 4 vector, the time component, the V0, just transforms as a scalar under rotations. This whole formalism is just using the rotation symmetry in the spatial axis. So as far as that rotation symmetry is concerned, V0 may as well just be a scalar. It doesn't matter that it belongs to a 4 vector. So I just have one extra degree of freedom here compared to the 3 vector case. And likewise, if I had, a symmetric 4 tensor, like the metric, the way that counting would work is that the 0, 0 component of the metric is a scalar under rotations. The 0i part of the metric is a 3 vector under rotations. And this is because it's symmetric, this is the same. And The space-space part of the metric is a symmetric three tensor under rotations. So I would just add the first three rows here and get 4, 1 times 2, 2 times 2, 1 times 2, for a total of 10 degrees of freedom. OK, so that's the SVT decomposition. Weinberg's theorem is a theorem about the scalar sector of FRW perturbation theory. So I'm generally going to simplify from the outset by just considering the scalar sector of the equations of motion. Okay. Now let's talk about FRW perturbation theory. Now this is we've talked about perturbations around an FRW background in the context of inflationary models where there are a limited number of degrees of freedom. But we also do FRW perturbation theory in the late universe, for example, to describe the CMB, where there are many degrees of freedom to keep track of the physics of waves propagating in the pre-CMB plasma. You know, we need on the order of a few tens of variables to describe, say, velocities of the different species of the universe, photons, dark matter particles, baryons, neutrinos, their pressure perturbations, their density perturbations. As the plasma becomes optically thin, it's not enough to, you have to keep track of a little phase space distribution around every point, leading to more degrees of freedom, and so on. The general subject of FRW perturbation theory is quite messy. Weinberg's theorem is nice because there's sort of one general statement you can make without getting into too many details of the equations of motion. You know, I ran into a friend of mine who's a practicing research cosmologist, and I mentioned that I was going to be talking about FRW perturbation theory in class, and she said, I hated that so much when I first saw it, it almost made me leave the field. This is actually, I must say, kind of a big mess, but I'm going to talk about as small of a subset of the mess as possible to discuss Weinberg's theorem. So first we're going to be keeping track of perturbations in the metric around an FRW background, and so. Here's a sort of 3 plus 1 dimensional notation for those fluctuations, which is, I haven't fixed a gauge yet. I'll talk about gauge fixing in a minute. So this is partially doing the SVT decomposition. The SVT decomposition, it's the part of the SVT decomposition that can be done in real space without including any derivative operators. So it's conventional to replace the metric by these functions a, bi, hl, and ht, which is traceless. By construction, because I've pulled the trace of the space-space part of the metric out into hl. I've written these, so I'm going to keep track of the metric instead of a set of g's. As these two scalar functions, a three vector and a symmetric three tensor. I've written the equations for the metric with upper components. You can easily invert and work out the equations of the metric for the lower components. But I won't write those out in the spirit of trying to write as few equations as possible to have some meaningful discussion of what the equations of motion are that go into Weinberg's theorem. Likewise, the stress energy tensor is a symmetric four tensor, but it's convenient to replace that 10 index object with a different set of variables that correspond a bit more physically to things like density perturbations, pressure perturbations, and so on. So here's my definition. So this definition is constructed so that if I perturb FRW by adding a perfect fluid with some velocity VI, some three velocity VI, that the meanings of delta rho VI and delta P in the equations are what you would expect them to be. So this pi object is traceless. This object pi is called the anisotropic stress, and it vanishes for a perfect fluid. It measures deviations of the stress energy tensor from isotropy in the rest frame. So if I had a situation, in the late universe where the perfect fluid approximation breaks down because dark matter particles start free streaming, and around a given point, I might have, say, a bunch of streams crossing, you would start to see anisotropic stress, but it's absent in the early universe. Okay, so the stress energy tensor I can replace by, these are just definitions. The stress energy tensor I can replace by a density perturbation delta P, a pressure perturbation delta, sorry, a density perturbation delta rho, a pressure perturbation delta P, a three vector velocity V, and a anisotropic stress pi ij, a symmetric traceless three tensor. If I write down these variables without any additional superscripts or subscripts, I mean the total stress energy tensor of the universe. If that stress energy is made up, is a sum of different components, say like a dark matter component, baryonic component, and so on, I'll sometimes put a little superscript J to indicate the particle species. Okay. Let's start keeping track of the number of degrees of freedom as I introduce more variables. So. Let's put you up here. Okay, so in the metric, you have 4 by 2 and 1 by 2. Where the 4 degrees of freedom, so there's a scalar in A. Well, A is a scalar. There's another scalar in the three vector B. I don't like the SVT terminology because it ambiguates two different types of vectors. Like B is a three vector, but in this SVT decomposition, we think of it as a scalar plus a vector. That it would really be better to say that the three vector V splits up as a helicity zero piece plus two helicity one pieces, but it'll be clear what type of vector I mean in context. Okay, so 10 degrees of freedom in the metric. In the stress energy, there were likewise same. Oh yeah, so under, you know, if I have a three vector, then it has a component, if for each Fourier mode K, it has a component that points in the direction of K. That's the spin zero part under rotations. And then two components that point perpendicular to K, those together are spin helicity plus or minus. Sorry? So the traceless symmetric three tensor Hij does have one scalar mode. It's the mode epsilon zero defined here. For Fourier wave number k, I can construct this traceless symmetric 2 tensor, which is invariant under rotations around the axis of k. Okay. This, if there were multiple species we were keeping track of, this 10 would be multiplied by the number of species. But let's just pretend there's only one species for now. Okay, next I'm going to talk about the gauge. So just like in the special case of inflation, we chose a gauge to fix equations of motion. That, generally speaking, in this FRW perturbation theory, we're free to change coordinates, which shifts the definitions of these fields around. You know, like in one coordinate system, maybe the density perturbation delta rho is zero. Well, that's just a coordinate-dependent statement. All it means is that the spatial slices of our coordinate system are synced up with surfaces of uniform density. And if I change to another coordinate, that won't be true. Delta rho will shift to something non-zero, but the other fields will shift around in some sort of consistent way. So that's what we want to work out. Just to show you how this is derived. If we consider an infinitesimal coordinate transformation, so we can work out formulas. Under this infinitesimal coordinate transformation, the general statement is that the components of some tensor T, which could have you know, any number of upper and lower indices, are the old components. Minus the Lie derivative with respect to this vector field epsilon of t. Is everyone okay, is everyone familiar with the Lie derivative? Is that something that you did in GR? Okay. Great. So just to show that how you would derive the formulas I'm about to write down, let's figure out how the object bi in the space-time part of the metric transforms under this type of coordinate transformation. So if epsilon mu, let me take epsilon mu and write its zero component as an epsilon t and its spatial component as epsilon sub t. And its spatial component is epsilon s, that's a three vector. The coordinate transformation I always think of as being first order. The same order in perturbation theory as the fluctuations themselves. Okay, so let's see. So GI, just to do one example, the Lie derivative, so to take the Lie derivative with the minus sign here, I take the ordinary partial derivative in the direction epsilon. And then I add terms which kind of look like a connection. They kind of look like Christoffel symbols with derivatives of epsilon. So there's a term that looks like partial where I swap out in the tensor the zero index for a row. And then there's a term where I swap out the I for a row. And now if we work these out, so G prime, I define B the three vector b so that g upper 0i was minus a inverse b. So I have minus a inverse b here. And then to work out each of these terms, remember that epsilon, the components of epsilon are first order. So I just use the zeroth order expression for the metric coefficients here. So this first guy is zero because g0i is zero at zeroth order. This term, the only term which is non-zero is the term where the four-index row is equal to I. So that brings down a partial I epsilon t times a to the minus 2. And then here, the only term which is non-zero is the term where rho is equal to 0. So that brings down a partial 0 epsilon s I times minus 1. OK, and then rearranging a little, I get the transformation law for B. Okay. So this is, working out these gauge transformation rules is a straightforward thing to do. We're just essentially working out the form of the Lie derivative under this change of variables. Okay. So let me just write down the general, the rest of the transformation laws. This is a formula. This is a formula. These formulas we're going to need to refer to. So maybe I'll put them over here. Let's put them here. Okay, this is the almost the end of like the equation dump before we state and prove Weinberg's theorem. Okay, cool. Okay, then last thing. Oh yeah, so how does the gauge enter this counting? Well, the gauge is parameterized by a four vector, which has two scalar degrees of freedom. Epsilon t is a scalar, and then epsilon s includes a Hilbert zero piece. 1 times 2 degrees of freedom in the vector sector. And then I want to put those degrees of freedom in with a minus sign, because these are degrees of freedom that I can use to set something else to zero, to remove degrees of freedom elsewhere. So I'm going to say this is minus 4 was 16. Okay. Last thing I need to do is some sort of writing down of Einstein's equations. Is it okay if I erase this? I have sort of the keep like a master equation board. Okay. So you can work out the gauge invariant Einstein equations. You can take this general form for the metric, work out its stress energy tensor, or sorry, its Einstein tensor. Then you can take the metric in this parameterization, or the stress energy tensor in this parameterization, set the Einstein tensor equal to 8 pi g times the stress energy tensor, and then get a set of Einstein equations which you can SVT decompose, and they'll relate various derivatives of the metric, the metric and its derivatives, to the stress energy. So that is some set of equations that one can write down with, you know, A, Bs, and Hs on the left-hand side, and delta rho's, delta Ps, Vs, and Pis on the right-hand side. But it's kind of long, and we're going to gauge fix in the end anyway. So I'm only going to partially going to write down Einstein's equations by writing them down in the Newtonian gauge. So the Newtonian gauge is the gauge where in the SVT decomposition, I set, so in the scalar sector only, I set B equals HT equals zero. So I use up these two scalar degrees of freedom in the gauge to set B and HT to zero. I wouldn't have enough gauge freedom, by the way, to set you know, with the indices to zero. That's too many degrees of freedom. I could, for example, I don't know, use up the vector piece to set the whole BI equal to zero. But it actually doesn't matter. We're just going to talk about the scalar vector and tensor sectors independently. So you can fix the gauge in the scalar sector independently of the others. So Newtonian gauge, when people say Newtonian gauge, they're really talking about the scalar sector only, and this is a complete description. It's also conventional to define when you write out, so the remaining degrees of freedom in the metric are the A and the HL. When you write equations in Newtonian gauge, it's conventional to call A phi and HL minus psi. Phi is what you think of as a gravitational potential, at least in the non-relativistic limit. It's fluctuations in the time part of the metric that are the GR generalization of the Newtonian potential. One way to see that it's the time component of the metric and not some other component is that, you know, if I have a non-relativistic particle, so that its four velocity is approximately 1,000, and it follows the geodesic equation. So the geodesic equation is keeping track of deflections due to gravity. Then, because of all the zeros here, the only Christoffel symbols that are important in sourcing the velocity are Christoffel symbols like I, like this, and gamma 0,0. Which, if you write out where they come from in this perturbed FRW metric, at least in this gauge with B equal to zero, they're all coming from the A. So a non-relativistic particle just feels fluctuations in the time part of the metric as the gravitational force that deflects its geodesics around. That's not true for a non-relativistic particle. And for example, in the for the case of a particle that actually travels at the speed of light, the potential that matters is actually phi plus psi. And one nice way to see that that's true is that for a non-relative for a null geodesic, the null geodesic doesn't change. If I conformally rescale the metric, if I pull out a constant factor. So I may as well set the, I could, for example, set the A equal to zero and put it into the HL. If you think about the way the signs work, what that means is that it's only the combination phi plus psi, which can affect the null geodesic. By the way, in the Newtonian gauge, it's often true that phi is equal to psi. As we'll see in a second, deviations from this relation only arise if you have anisotropic stress around. So in most situations, these two potentials are approximately equal. And this is like the famous factor of two in the GR bending of light. A non-relativistic particle just sees phi as its potential. A particle moving at the speed of light sees 2 phi approximately. Okay. So in this gauge, the Einstein equations, you could either work out the Einstein equations, run the GR machine with this gauge fixed from in advance, or you could work out the fully gauge invariant Einstein equations and fix the gauge at the end. That is a very long, but in principle, straightforward calculation. I have to admit, I've actually never done it. I like calculating, so I like to just reproduce stuff just for the, bragging rights, I guess. But in this case, I never actually, at one point I started, but I never actually went and calculated the Einstein tensor for this metric and the stress energy tensor, wrote everything out in terms of these variables, and worked out the Einstein's equations. So the books where this is written down probably aren't lying to me. So let me write them down. So the great thing about the Newtonian gauge, so generally speaking, when you write down Einstein's equations, the Einstein equation g mu nu equals 8 pi g t mu nu contains, by the Bianchi identity, the statement that the stress energy is conserved. You get mathematical inconsistencies in GR if you try to couple to a stress at like an external stress energy that doesn't satisfy this conservation law. So the Einstein's equations will always, so this is 10 equations and this is 4. So generally speaking, the Einstein's equations will contain, you can always structure them as these 4 equations, conservation laws, plus 6 other equations that tell you how the metric perturbations are sourced by the stress energy tensor. Now in the scalar sector, let's write down the counting over here actually. Forwarding down the equations. So Einstein's equations. Let's say that Einstein's equations are 10 equations, but let's say we think of 4 of those equations as being conservation laws for the stress energy, and 6 of them as being gravitational, the analogs of, Newton's force law. So the conservation laws follow the same counting as a 4 vector. This equation has a 4 vector on each side. So conservation laws are giving me 2 equations in the scalar sector and 1 times 2 equations in the vector sector. And then the gravitational part, so let's say I took an equation which was a symmetric 4 tensor and then removed a 4 vector from it. So I would have the degrees of freedom of a symmetric tensor minus those of a vector. So that turns out to be 2. Oh, I shouldn't have this. That'll be 2 minus 1 times 2 minus 2 times 2. Okay. I'm going to put these in with a minus sign because the Einstein's equations are equations that have to be satisfied that are effectively removing, determining the evolution of some of the variables. So what I'm adding up here is the number of undetermined variables, the number of remaining equations of motion that are needed to close the system. So minus 4, minus 6, 10. In the scalar sector, if you do the bookkeeping, I have a balance of 2. In the vector sector, 1. And in the tensor sector, oh, sorry guys, this should be 1 times 2. Okay, so these are the number of missing equations. I'll talk more about them in a sec. First, let me finish writing down the Einstein's equations. In the scalar sector, I expect to have 2 gravitational laws and 2 conservation laws. These are the gravitational laws. And here are the conservation laws. Delta P. In my handwriting, rho and P look almost the same, so just shout if you see like an ambiguous pseudo P somewhere. This screws me up in my own calculations. Like I do a calculation and somewhere along the way a rho mutates into a P or vice versa. Okay. So this is it for the equation inventory. So just to interpret these equations a little bit, you know, the first equation is saying that phi is equal to psi unless you have anisotropic stress around. If you have anisotropic stress around, then it sources phi minus psi with a 1 over r squared, or, you know, 1 over r type kernel because of the k squared. It's just like Newton's law. The second equation looks just like Newton's law or Poisson's equation, just telling you the gravitational potential. It actually turns out to be psi that directly appears in the equation here. But of course, if you don't have anisotropic stress, it may as well be phi. So this is telling you that in this Newtonian gauge, a matter fluctuation sources the potential in the usual way, plus this relativistic correction, which is small, which only becomes important if, you know, velocities are close to the speed of light. It might seem odd that in a GR situation, I have an instantaneous force law here. I mean, the way this works is that if I have a delta rho somewhere in space, it just instantaneously sources the psi somewhere else. But if you, it always works out. That's just a consequence of the gauge fixing. It always works out so that, you know, if physical signals propagate at the speed of light. And then these other equations are just equations that express, continuity equations that express conservation of total mass and total momentum. Now these equations are incomplete. And they're incomplete by the amount shown here. In this case where I just have one particle species, I would need 2 more equations of motion in the scalar sector to close the system. What are those missing equations? They're equations that tell you how, roughly speaking, these equations are telling you how to, the continuity equations are telling you how to follow the evolution of rho and v. So what you need to close the system are equations that tell you about the pressure and anisotropic stress. For example, for a perfect fluid with constant equation of state, The equations would say that the pressure perturbation is just W times the density perturbation, and the anisotropic stress pi is equal to zero. If I have more species, if I add a bunch of species, then this number of equations doesn't change. So I need to add more and more equations as I add species. And these are those are always going to be rules telling you how to get delta p and pi. And also rules which tell you how these conservation laws get modified by forces between the particles. For example, the pressure perturbation of species J might look like this, which is what you would get if there were no forces acting, plus some source terms that depend on what the other particle species are doing if they are exerting forces on each other. Okay, so that is the system of equations that we're going to be talking about, and I'm going to prove Weinberg's theorem. Which states that regardless of the equations of motion, so even though the equations are incomplete, and I haven't really said much except for some qualitative statements about what the missing equations are, the scalar sector has a solution. On large scales, so in the situation where the wavelength is larger than the horizon, that applies after inflation and before the CMB is generated. And you can even sort of construct the solution. So let me start writing it down as a power series in K over AH. So this is just in the scalar sector, so everything is at one Fourier mode K, and I'm just keeping track of the scalar degrees of freedom, so there won't be any indices. Plus terms of order, I think K squared over AH squared. Terms of order K over AH squared. There are perturbations in particle species that look like this. So there's some you'll see where this comes from. Let me prove the theorem, which is going to be next time. Kind of a mess. I wrote down the coefficients. The function alpha of t here is this function. which is it takes approximately this constant value for constant w, or if w has been constant in the last few Hubble times. So these detailed coefficients, I just wrote down to convey that this is a very sharply defined theorem that gives an explicit solution. Now it's I find this theorem really remarkable that you can say anything about the solutions to an equation of motion, to a set of equations of motion that we haven't even really written down. We partially wrote them down, but we said they were incomplete. But nevertheless, there's a general symmetry argument that proves that the solution exists, and it gives all the leading coefficients, but sub-leading coefficients undetermined. Those come from the missing equations. And this is the mode. We'll also show that in single field inflation, so it's generally true that this mode exists. We'll also show that in single field inflation, the universe leaves inflation in precisely this mode. So this theorem is defining the initial conditions because single field inflation is our assumption in our standard cosmological model. This set of equations is defining the initial conditions of the standard cosmological model. They're telling you, rearrange slightly, they tell you how to build fluctuations in all of the relevant degrees of freedom, the metric potentials and all of the stress energy components out of one field, the adiabatic curvature zeta. So next time, we'll give the super fun proof of this theorem.